Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 here with a special guest. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, hello everybody. My name is Craig Brockschmidt. I've been here at Microsoft since 1988, although I took 12 years off in the middle. So I've been around a long time in this industry, and a lot of people recognize me from giving talks at Build and other conferences and writing a number of books over the years. I wrote two editions of Inside Olay way back in the 90s, which were the Olay and Com Bibles.
Yeah.
It was real fun years later when I came to the Windows team and I still had brand name recognition.
Nice.
Because the guys still had the books on their shelves and were saying, hey, you're the guy that wrote the book about Com. It's like, yeah, I was the third person in the world that understood it. Don Box was the fourth, Chris Sells was the fifth. And
there's a bunch of us that are still trying to understand
actually. It's like, what's I unknown for, you know? But we had fun with that. And when I was with the Windows team in 2010 timeframe with Windows 8, wrote two editions of a book on programming Windows apps with JavaScript. So that was a pretty widely downloaded. I think the two editions are over 1 million downloads. So
that's cool because there's such different technologies.
Yeah.
So when you came, did you come as an employee? Did you start as an intern? What group did you work with?
Yeah, I actually started as an intern in 1988. It was with developer support.
Okay.
And so we were the guys answering phone calls from Windows developers. And at the time, it was Windows version 2. There weren't many of them.
Uh-huh.
And you could pick up the phone, call the number, and get one of us live.
Wow.
And say, and the interns, the young college kids, we were the ones answering the frontline phones. And there was a bank of full-time employees who we'd escalate to.
Sure.
So if we couldn't answer things right off, we'd give it to them. But what was really fun about that job is that we had Windows developers, and then we had MS-DOS end users.
Oh, interesting.
Back and forth, because we were operating environments. That was the name of our group, and so somehow DOS fell into that. So we would get, a guy who would be lecturing me about how much older he was, because I was 19, and how much more he knew, and don't give me any nonsense because I'm going to see right through it. And, and you have to be very respectful and say, yes, sir, what can I help you with? And then the next guy would be somebody actually attempting to fold a 5 1/4 floppy disk and shove it into a 3.5-inch drive, or they wanted a copy, two floppies, so they'd take two and they'd shove them in the drive together. One of my favorite stories that I think it was a little past my time was somebody called in and said, and this was when you ran a lot of stuff off the floppy because you had a 20 or 40 megabyte hard drive, which was kind of big, but still not enough to hold everything. And so they'd say, I put in the disk, I ran everything off of it, and then when I came back later and tried it again, the disk was bad. It's like, okay, fine, we'll send you a new disk. And he got the new disk, and the same thing happened. It worked once, and then it didn't work again. And then they sent him a third disk, and same thing. And people are in support are scratching their heads going, what's going on with this? Okay, next time, we're going to send you a new disk, and let's walk through the process and find out exactly what you're doing. And so they did that. They ran it and installed it or whatever. Everything worked fine. And then the customer said, and now I'm hanging the disk back up.
What?
Hanging? What do you mean by hanging? Well, I'm sticking it to my file cabinet with a magnet.
Oh, no.
Which, of course, our young audience may not know that it used to be magnetic media and it would scramble the bits. It didn't happen with CDs or USB sticks or whatever else.
Oh, kids today are so spoiled.
You can see I got the racing stripes here by now. So.
That's awesome. And so tell me about some of the questions. Obviously, that's the MS-DOS side, which was the actual operating system of the day.
That's right.
What were some of the questions you got on the Windows side?
Well, a lot of people were exploring Windows programming for the first time and just trying to understand how graphics stuff worked and GDI, and trying to get a font loaded properly or trying to get, a font to render or just doing windowing. Windows 2 was the first time we had overlapping windows because Windows 1 was this tiled setup that for what came out in 1985. And I'd actually seen that on I'd worked at the University of Washington where I went to school. I had worked as a volunteer in a computer support lab. And I kind of got, that's why I got the support job really easily is because I'd been doing support of some kind. And they had Macs, the original little white Macs and some IBM PCs running Windows 1 and kind of got exposed to it that way. And I remember visiting my future father-in-law at Boeing.
Nice.
And he had Windows 1 on his machine and some other cool software. The graphical user interface was so cool.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember the next internship I had in apps development was during the production phase of Windows 3.0, and the production phase of Word for Windows 1. And together the two would crash like every 2 minutes.
Wow.
You know, and this was where you booted into DOS and then you typed win on the command line and it booted mm-hmm. Windows. You know, now you don't even, it just, yeah, that it is the operating yeah. system. And so even with it crashing every 2 minutes, it was still really productive to work in the graphical Word and on Windows. It was such an amazing experience. But I think at that time I wrote the first autosave for Word, which was this little program that ran in the background, and there was a messaging protocol called DDE, Dynamic Data Exchange. It was just the Windows messages you sent. Mm-hmm. And so I figured out how Word could be driven, and I just told it to save every 10 seconds.
Oh, nice!
And it worked really well. But we got a lot of questions about, you know, windowing and fonts, and memory management was a big thing. You were all writing in C, and everybody was trying to learn about pointers, and the heap and the stack and
yeah, you know different things.
You're looking through that program called HeapWalker, which let you see all the memory segments, including the one named Burgermaster, which everybody scratched their heads over for years, and they'd call in and say, "What's Burgermaster for?" And the story of that goes, if you go in the old Microsoft building at the 520-405 interchange mm-hmm. over here, there's a Burgermaster restaurant that was right outside the window of the guy who was trying to name these memory segments, and he couldn't come up with the names. So how about Burgermaster?
You know, naming things is one of the hardest programming challenges that's that we
right.
have.
And so we just used that, and it lived in infamy for many years. We had a lot of really difficult questions sometimes of just how things were running, why things were crashing, or just how to do something with user interface, how to write a custom control, how to how to get my buttons hooked up properly and those kinds of
That's
things.
That's interesting because when you go from like a DOS sort of a type and command and things just happen yeah. to a window type of thing, mm-hmm. there's like a whole other couple of dimensions you need to worry about. Well, the memory yeah. was scarce back then.
Yeah, and it was a cooperative environment so that you had to play nice with the other apps.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that you got to take over the system and do whatever you wanted. You had to process messages and only take the ones that were for you. And not screw up everybody else's, because you actually got everybody's messages. If you were the foreground app, all the messages in the system came through your little message pump.
And the other thing that's interesting is that, if I remember correctly, you could literally, if you were savvy enough, could write into the kernel memory space and screw everybody up.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like, it's the Wild West out
there. Well, I had this one time talking to WordPerfect, and a year or two later, I was supporting them directly when they were writing their first version for Windows. And they had this weird problem where, like, they're typing along and every sixth or seventh character would disappear. Now, at that time, I had been dissecting Windows user module. There was user kernel and GDI were the three main pieces. So this was the user interface module. And I just went into the source code and I was pulling it apart and trying to figure out all the intricacies of how it worked. And I realized in seeing the message pump that if you didn't call this one API called translate message, which turned a keystroke into a character, That wouldn't happen. But because you were all cooperatively processing messages, their app wasn't calling that API, but all the other programs were. So it was like every seventh message or so came through theirs and didn't get translated.
Oh my goodness. So there's like this,
yeah.
you had to be like a really good citizen, first of all, because you could hose someone else's app.
That's right, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
It was kind of scary by today's standards.
And nowadays, obviously, this is not even the case. Everyone's in their own user-protected mode, and then kernel's different and so on.
Yeah, which only started with the 386 processor when you could even first think about doing that.
Really? So what was the architectural difference that sort of helped that from 286 to 386?
I honestly don't remember. I have to admit, it's been so long. But there was something about a protected mode that you could turn on in the 386, which would isolate a process from other processes. And it was a special mode you had to turn on. And so in Windows 2 timeframe, there was another product called Windows/386, which took advantage of that. It's like the difference between Windows 16 and Win32 that came about. So kind of interesting times to see how badly you could screw up everybody else.
Like it literally was as if we had all of the knobs available to us as the programmer and some that you probably shouldn't
have. But the fact of the matter is there weren't that many knobs. The Windows SDK manual, it was printed in this three-ring binder. It was, maybe there were like 400 APIs.
That's awesome.
And, later on, when we added the Olay and COM technologies that I worked on a lot, it like tripled the API surface area with all this stuff it added. And that was still only like 1,800. And then .NET came along and made it 70,000, 80,000, and just exploded since then with, literally, over 1 million, I think, or maybe it's 800,000 total APIs in Windows. on the surface there. That's why the Windows runtime was kind of reinvented in the Windows 8 timeframe, just to shrink it back down and make it more navigable, because it had gotten out of control, really.
So you're saying that during the Windows 8 and then later 10 timeframe, mm-hmm. it sort of, the surface area sort of shrunk down again?
Intentionally, yeah. With the Windows runtime API was an intentional effort to get it more manageable again. And also something you didn't have to wait for a framework like .NET to surface those APIs. They could be used by multiple languages right out of the box.
That's awesome. So there is a program that almost everyone has at least seen once, and we're talking billions of people.
Billions of people.
And, and it's something that you actually worked on. Why don't you talk about calc.exe?
I'll talk about calc. So back to Windows 1 and Windows 2 had this little four-function calculator. And the Windows 1 ran in this little tiled box, and Windows 2 was a nice overlap calculator. But it was four functions, add, subtract, multiply, and divide. And I was an engineering student at the University of Washington during my first internship, and I needed to learn how to write Windows programs. And this was C, Windows SDK, Petzold's book. And so I just started writing some stuff, and I by the time I got, I think I wrote two real simple little graphical kind of things. And then I said, I need something real. And I said, this calculator is totally insufficient. I'm an engineering student. I need something better. So I had this scientific calculator that I bought at Kmart in high school. It was $10. And I said, let me make that on Windows and actually make a fuller scientific calculator. It was a great learning project. I learned all kinds of stuff about UI and about memory and just about the platform. And somewhere along the way, my manager showed it to the Windows 3 team. Now, granted, this is a time when Microsoft was 2,500 people.
Yeah.
And it was buildings 1 through 6 over there. That was it. All these buildings that we're in right now were owned by other companies or not even here.
Sure.
And so they were, we were in building 6, they were in building 4 or something. So it was just a short walk. And the Windows 3 team saw it and said, hey, that's cool, we'll ship it.
Were you surprised by that?
Yeah. It's like, that's pretty cool for a 19-year-old support intern, not even a developer intern, but a support intern to get a product in the box. Mm-hmm. So I started working with that team, especially after it was a 6-month internship. So when I went back to school for my junior year, I continued just contact with the team and doing some work on the program. It seemed like this is where I learned about program managers. That like every week they changed their mind about something. Oh, we want to have different colors and different this and different that. At one point we had, because it took a long time to render the 48 buttons or whatever were on that calculator, and you could kind of see them appearing. Uh-huh. So we said, why don't we put it in a spiral pattern or something else, and change the colors and do this and do that. And we were trying to keep the size of Windows 3 down, so it was a bad thing if I got the XE over 40K.
Oh.
I was trying to keep it down and keep it tight and fixing bugs and all that kind of stuff. So. Continued working on that. The next spring, I did some actual contract work with the apps that were Cardfile and Calendar and the clock. Like I add this digital font to the clock and tried to make it italic, but they didn't want that. And I tried putting it back in, and they kept taking it out. And we had this little tussle actually in the Source Depot. It was this system. It was just on a file server, and it was called Source Library Manager (SLM) or SLIME for short. So we loved using that acronym SLIME. And they were really trying to keep the footprint down because it had to go on floppies, and a few more bytes might make another floppy, which was could be millions of dollars in cost of goods at the end of the day. So there were the code police that were ripping out anything extraneous. And I tried to get a Control-I key into the clock to italicize the font to make it a little more digital. And I would check it in, somebody would take it out, I'd check it again, they'd take it out.
Oh,
I even went to the file server directly without letting a history of check in, check out, made the change, and somebody still found it and took it out.
That's hilarious.
But what was really funny is that they took out all this extraneous stuff, including like any Easter eggs and things like that, although the Windows 3 team managed to keep one in there. If you typed a certain sequence of keystrokes in just the right order, it would put up a background bitmap with everybody's names in it. That's another story I don't have time to go into, but I discovered how they did that and revealed it to the team one day, and they said, oh, you found our secret. But in Windows 3, there were two people that actually got their names in the product. So Wes Cherry, who wrote Solitaire, the first version of that.
Very
everybody
important
knows,
program.
Very important, That's biggest right. time waster in the history
That's
of technology.
Right.
So I had to counter with the productive side of Calc.
That's right.
So he had his name in the About box, and because my manager said, well, we don't know if Craig's going to come back to work here later on. He, you know, he still's got 2 years of school left. Why don't you put his name in there too? Mm-hmm. So they put it in there and pretty much stayed in there through Windows 95 because this program, I did a little bit more in 1989 with it, but really after the summer of 89, I haven't touched the code at all.
Sure.
Somebody else took it over. They were maintaining it. But it shipped in Windows 3, 3.1, 3.11, NT 3, NT 4, you know, Windows 95. After Windows 95, I had retired from Microsoft on, I was in enough an era, I call it. I wasn't one of those multimillionaire guys. That
nice.
My wife and I simplified our lives so I could just live on income for a while. And so I wasn't there anymore. So Windows 98 doesn't have my name in it, but it's still the same program.
Yeah.
Windows ME, same program. Windows XP, same program. Windows Vista, same program. So this thing had a long lifetime all the way through Vista, virtually unchanged. And then Windows 7, it got a facelift and got added like some statistical functions and some other modes
sure.
other than scientific. But it was still the same source base. And in fact, when they made the Windows 8 version, the full screen tablet oriented version, you can watch this in one of the build sessions, I think from 2012 or 2013, where mm-hmm. the team that built that talks about how they did all the fonts and made everything really precise. And in that talk, they mention how they made sure this program replicated the behavior of the earlier calc. And I'm going, that's me. That's me.
That's so awesome.
You know, and I was just an intern, just kind of hacking my way through it. And you know, there's some curious little bugs if you do things like 2 minus 2 equals 0.00000. You know, those are just calculation bugs. I didn't do rounding in quite a way that I might do it today if I sat down to write it again.
So this was all written in C.
In straight C, yeah.
And you use sort of the old API for windowing. Mm-hmm. That API sort of carried forward in all the versions after that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of those that are still there today for backwards compatibility. You can still pick up some really old Windows programs and run them on Windows 10.
And it works just fine.
Yeah. I don't know. I think a lot of the old 16-bit programs have lost compatibility. They may have needed to be brought forward to 32-bit.
I see.
Ask Raymond Chen sometime about compatibility. He used to send out an email called Brain Dead App of the Day. Because this was the Windows 95 timeframe, mm-hmm. I think it was. And he was the guy who, anytime we found an application that wasn't compatible, because we wanted total compatibility with Windows 95, he got to diagnose why. And so he'd get these wonderful stories about, you know, he bought this, like, I can't believe this app is using a GP fault to talk to itself. And what app is this? It's Microsoft COBOL 5,
oh,
you know? And he'd build up the story, and they were just hilarious.
Are those saved anywhere?
I don't know. You'd have to ask Raymond, you know? I don't know if he has them on his blog or something like that.
So you're working for Microsoft now. Mm-hmm. What are you doing?
So I work as a content developer in the Cloud and Enterprise division. So kind of just to give my career chronology in a short way, I did developer support for that internship. I did apps development. I worked on what became Microsoft Mail eventually. Mm-hmm. I basically spent a summer rewriting C routines in assembly language. Which was great because I went back to the first class of my senior year I had on microprocessors on the 386 or the 8086 it was still. Like, I knew how to execute assembly by looking at it.
Sure.
So the final exam came around. They gave us 2 hours. I finished it in 5 minutes.
Nice. That's
awesome. It was a nice way to spend a summer. But then after I graduated, I went back to developer support because I always loved helping people and helping developers succeed.
Sure.
And even in high school, I had written articles for magazines and shared the knowledge I was gaining. That's why I liked support work.
I see.
Because I got to be technical. I got to do a lot of writing. I got to do some training. Got to answer questions, but I also got to do the coding.
Absolutely.
And I found I learned a lot in that role. And I was only there 14 months, I think, as a full-timer, and then got picked up by the developer relations group when it was really early on. This mm-hmm. is what became our whole evangelism organization of DPE and now DX. Mm-hmm. So this was started really early on, just a few evangelists, and along the way, after they had about 15 evangelists, they said, we need a real technical person who could, you know, actually get into the code with the customers we're trying to help, you know, before the product ship. So support was always after the operating system ship. Now I got to work on the early side of it, you know, when we were working with early partners. And I worked in that for the next 5+ years before I took my time off. Uh-huh. And just really loved that level of engagement. And that's when I wrote the books on Olay and Calm and traveled all over giving talks and training the world about this stuff.
Oh, it's so much fun to do that.
Yeah, it was exhausting, but it was a lot of fun. And then, you know, decided, you know, I was 28 at the time that, you know, God, I can't think of anything else to do with a career. In this, I'd done everything I could have imagined for myself. And because I had the means, I just took time off and did a whole bunch of different stuff. Mm-hmm. Anywhere from, you know, forestry and construction to technology and office work. And my wife was a gift buyer at East West Bookshop mm-hmm. over here in Seattle for a time and helped her do a bunch of stuff with that. And worked with children and education and music and singing and travel.
This was like 12 years that you had.
Yeah.
You didn't take off. You just literally took time to do something else.
I did. Yeah. And I didn't need to be paid for anything. So anytime there was some job that somebody could think up that nobody knew how to do it, you couldn't pay anybody to do it. It's like, hey, I'll jump in. I'll try. I'll learn how to weld.
I'll
learn how to, you know, work solar panels or, you know, manage a forest land or something like that. So it was a lot of fun. And part of that in that time was starting family as well. So in 2003, my wife and I said, well, it's probably time. We were in our late 30s by then. Or mid-30s, and we're saying it's about time, you know, we think about that. We moved to Portland to kind of clarify that decision. All our families are up here, so it's a little distance.
Yeah, you
know? And then our son came along in 2006, and that was just a joy, and it was great that I could spend really his first year and a half with him all the time. So I had a really good experience with that. But by the time he was a year and a half, we saw this kid's going to want to travel a lot. I mean, he's such a good traveler and loves exploring things. And we said, probably need to finance his future a little bit.
Sure.
So I got in touch with old friends here in 2008 and said, hey, I'm just looking for, put my toe in the water with a little contract work. And they said, we got something perfect for you. Actually, it was built on the Olay and Calm technologies. Mm-hmm. And the same guy that architected that, Tony Williams, was architecting this technology. So it was a nice way to step back in. And after doing that for 6 months, they invited me back to be a regular employee again. And I could work remote from Portland. I started out part-time and became full-time later. And was, did that for until 2010 when the product we had, which some people may remember, this whole thing called Project Oslo and this thing called the M programming language and writing grammars for domain-specific languages and this other thing we had called Quadrant, which was really cool. We couldn't figure out what to do with the product. And so they decided to cancel it and kind of scattered us all. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in the Windows team doing, in the ecosystem team, which was helping partners.
Sure.
Helping early adopters. So it was really a lot like the developer relations work I did. And that's when I wrote the two Windows programming books along the way. And then just a year and a half ago, moved over to the Cloud and Enterprise division to do content development. So along my career, I've always gravitated back to doing either content or community
or
both.
Or helping.
Yeah, I like to be the bridge that goes out to developers. I have apparently an ability, a good empathy with the way an outside developer sees things, but then I can also communicate with all the guys on the inside that are building it and say, how do I take their knowledge and transmit it to the outside guy in a way that you understand? So what I'm doing now in that same vein is all centered around cross-platform mobile apps.
Okay.
So with the technologies of Xamarin, Cordova, and little touched on a little bit with Unity and C++ tooling. There's a whole opportunity there with the DevOps picture around mobile that it's a very scattered environment right now. Not a lot of clarity or, you know, there's so many different options to work with there. And even DevOps doesn't have a clear understanding of what it's about, right? And what it is. And I just did a talk in Romania, in Bucharest, at the Microsoft Summit there. And Romania is the hotbed of development in Europe right now.
Mm-hmm.
You got a lot of really super talented developers, a lot of great energy. And I took up this thing, let me talk about mobile app cross-platform DevOps. And got to an understanding where if you really look at everything in the whole app lifecycle other than just your managing your backlog and your team boards and communication and the coding part and maybe debugging locally, but from the moment you check code in to your repository all the way through the production line, through production monitoring, every step of the way what you want to be doing is validating the app's performance. In the way that we think of performance like an athlete, or an actor or a musician, you know, that they rehearse, they train, they practice, they look at their performances, and they deliver a great performance that we're willing to pay for. And apps have to do the same thing. So just as athletes and actors and all that do training and rehearsing and looking at their performances, that's what all the form, most of DevOps is about that for software.
Interesting.
That we have, you know, things like unit testing and UI testing and, you know, load testing your back end and usability testing and beta testing, crowd testing, and then you have production monitoring. And even your build is a form of testing, because if it doesn't build, it's broken. Right, it has to go through build to go to the next stage of testing. So you can really look, pick up DevOps from that thread of continuously validating the performance of your app through the whole stage of its life cycle from the moment the code is written.
What a good way to think about it. Yeah. It's literally like you're getting your app ready for the show.
That's right.
And what are some things that might happen during the show that you need to be ready for?
Yeah, I like to say that great apps deliver great performances.
Sure.
Not performance in the way that we usually talk about it. You know, even just recently, you were doing interviews after Connect and talking about like performance between Xamarin and Cordova, and people get right into the question of native code versus JavaScript and all that. Fact of the matter is that JavaScript engines are so good nowadays that between JavaScript and C++ compiled is maybe sometimes like a 35% difference. It's not hundreds of percent. It's relatively small, and it's maybe 20% slower than C#. But it's not... You know, but if you're not dealing with your back end, like it could take 5 seconds to get something from your back end. And so what if it takes 50 or 100 milliseconds to process? You know, you got to look at the whole picture, which is what that DevOps view gives you, is saying it's about, yes, it's about the code and the performance in the app, but it's about all the relationships the app has to its back end, to the system, to the platform it's running on, the variances between devices.
Sure.
And we have to validate the performance across that whole life cycle, across the whole span of multiple platforms, multiple device types, multiple versions of those platforms, and different users around the world.
Right.
Because we're in a global market. So that's a big space.
Yeah,
and I'm having a lot of fun kind of trying to tease it apart and make some sense of it.
It feels like it's, I mean, because I was going to ask you, where do you see our field going in the future? But it feels like what you're telling me is that DevOps is this sort of ripe field, ripe for innovation, ripe for pushing forward our space.
Yeah, and there's a lot of opportunity with that, like just in Visual Studio Team Services, renamed from Visual Studio Online just recently. Because it's extensible and you can put in all these little extensions to do different parts of your build processes and other stuff, it's very ripe for integrating all the different variances of DevOps concerns into an automated process in a cloud build service.
Awesome.
Which is very cool.
Well, just to finish up, where can people go to find out more about you, some of the stuff you've written, and what you think about technology in general?
So I do have a website where I do some blogging, not as active as I used to be, but craigbrockschmidt.com, and that's Craig with a K. you'll get that. You can see it. Just search on the name, and I'm sure you'll see it on the bottom of this video. So I do blog there and have just other stuff from my own history and even like recordings of singing performances I've done and stuff like that.
Okay, that's awesome.
And you'll see me popping up in MSDN Magazine on occasion. I did some articles last year. And you know, I publish stuff on MSDN, on the Cordova Tools documentation. I've done some work on Xamarin's documentation. Yep. I really like with those guys really well. You know, again, Charles Betzold is an old friend of mine that is working there now on Xamarin Forms.
Uh-huh.
So just do a search. You'll find plenty about me. I've been around a long time. So.
Well, awesome. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. It's always neat to see sort of the history of our field, because it feels like you've been on the cutting edge straight from the beginning to now, cutting edge on DevOps, cutting edge on Windows. It's pretty cool to have you.
Yeah, you know, my first computer was 4K of memory, you know, and less than 1 megahertz of processor speed. And it's amazing what you could do with it, you know.
Yeah, it is. Well, thanks for spending some time with us, bud.
Anytime.
Thanks so much for watching. And this is Channel 9. We're here with our special guest. Please find out more about what he's done below in the links. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. Take care.